Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Boeing had $100 billion in revenue last year, $60 billion of that from commercial aviation. So you bet they want to know whether you're going to get on that plane. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 12th of March. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. There are not small parts of this planet where airlines are just not allowed to fly the Boeing 737 MAX 8 in the wake of that Ethiopian Airlines flight this weekend. China and the European Union, to name just two. Not so far, though, the United States. But there is mounting pressure, I think that is the stock phrase, on the FAA to do something about it. John Ostrower is a longtime aviation journalist, also now the editor-in-chief of The Air Current. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let me cut to the chase here. If this had been, say, Southwest or American and one of their 737 MAX 8s, would the FAA have grounded those things already?
Almost certainly. I think you have to look at the severity of this and how much of a statistical aberration this is in an era of incredible aviation safety. The most important thing is finding out what happened to the Ethiopian flight and concluding the investigation right. into what went on in Indonesia. But the bottom line is the standard for safety that we have right now, we hold our aviation system to, is absolutely tremendous. And we have to go back to the 60s and 70s, even the 50s, to find a case where you've lost two aircraft in new aircraft in this kind of rapid succession.
Let's assume, just for the heck of it, that in the next 24 hours, the political pressure mounts on the FAA, as it is already doing. There are members of Congress calling for the FAA to ground this plane. What does Boeing do? Obviously, it doesn't fly. The airlines can't fly it. But then what happens?
So what happens is, and this is the tricky part, right. because if you establish a grounding, you have to establish a criteria for which you get out of that grounding as well.
Huh.
You know, what will satisfy the flying public? What will satisfy regulators? What will satisfy airlines? And that's something that's going to be have to decided potentially in advance of this grounding. And this is, you know, what ultimately happened when the 787 was grounded was that
it was battery fires, right? Lithium battery fires.
It was, yeah. And so in those situations on two Japanese Dreamliners back in 2013, those events in rapid succession just a few weeks apart caused the grounding of the airplane. And ultimately, one of the challenges was how do you get out of the grounding? So a lot of the lessons from that are being applied right now to anything the FAA is thinking about. But the political pressure is enormous. I mean, yeah. It is the rest of the world against the FAA right now, and they want to be data-driven behind what they're doing and understand what the link is or not. But ultimately, it's such an aberration. You know, out of an abundance of caution, we see airlines and regulators taking this step.
How remarkable is it that the FAA is not leading the way? You've got federal aviation regulators in more than a dozen or two dozen other countries saying, no, this plane's not flying, and the FAA is not leading the way.
It is significant. I think they're trying to hold the line on their view that they want to understand if there is a link or not a link. You know, I think it comes back to the idea that you have obviously the first main regulator to stand down this airplane was China.
Yeah.
And China is trying to assert itself in its own role as a global regulator with a third of these airplanes flying. So it is a sign of a new time to some extent where you see China asserting itself in this way
right.
In global leadership or on aviation safety.
Right. And we should say here, Asia is a huge, if not the biggest market for Boeing products, right?
China is the single biggest market. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Asia is the single biggest market.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And China is part and parcel the key to the future for both Boeing and Airbus. They need right. Chinese demand for their airplanes.
John Ostrower is the editor-in-chief of The Air Current. John, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thanks so much.
Remember the market lesson from yesterday, the perils of price-weighted indexes? Ticker symbol BA, Boeing, a Dow component, lost another 6% today, dragged the blue chips just a tad lower. Other indices were just a tad higher. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Theresa May's horrible, no good, very bad prime ministership continued on course today. A slightly polished but mostly unchanged version of the Brexit withdrawal deal she negotiated with the European Union got torpedoed in Parliament this afternoon. 242 yeas, 391 nays, which means more votes in Westminster the next couple of days about whether to just up and leave without a deal or whether to try to just put the whole thing off for a while. Thing is, needless to say, there is some anxiety going on over there, seeing as how Brexit is supposed to happen 2 weeks from this coming Friday. And it's not just worries over tariffs that would go up between Britain and continental Europe. Some businesses are also eyeing a government plan, if there is that no-deal Brexit, to cut most UK import tariffs to zero. From Stoke-on-Trent, the heart of Britain's once mighty ceramics industry, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This vintage canal barge is an exhibit in a Stoke museum celebrating this city's rich industrial heritage. Barges like this once brought clay into the potteries here and then ferried the finished product, fine tableware, out to the world. Brands like Wedgwood, Spode and Royal Doulton.
Stoke were famed for turning dirt into art and then exporting it to the four corners of the globe.
Heritage champion and former owner of a small ceramics firm, Councillor Dan Jelliman.
There's products that were made here which are in Washington, D.C., in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, in South Africa, in every part of the world there's a bit of Stoke-on-Trent.
The British ceramics industry is long past its heyday. It has, though, in recent years staged a revival. Nationally, it's been growing at 9% a year. Today, it employs 22,000 people. But that recovery is now at risk thanks to Brexit, as Alan Smith, boss of local firm Dunoon Ceramics, told Channel 4.
I do fear for the ceramic industry. I do fear for it. We've got people, as I say, that have been working here for a long time with us. They've developed skills, and once these skills have gone, we've lost control. A whole industry could be decimated.
If there's a no-deal Brexit, his company, which makes decorative mugs, will for the first time face tariffs on exports to continental Europe and to other countries that currently have a free trade deal with the EU.
People who I think voted to leave the European Union, I'm sure they didn't want to see the decline of a whole industry. And it seems quite unfair now that the rug's been pulled from under us.
It's not just the hurdle of increased export tariffs that the ceramics industry fears. It's also the British government plan, in the event of a no-deal Brexit, to slash most import tariffs to 0%. The idea, to give a boost to consumers and to companies importing raw materials and components. But Laura Cohen of the British Ceramics Confederation says it would be disastrous for her industry.
At present, for example, an Indian or Brazilian dinner plate would have a 12% tariff coming into Britain. Under government plans, it would be reduced to zero. We'd be flooded by imports.
And that competitive threat in the home market would come on top of the headwind of increased tariffs on UK exports.
It really is a double whammy.
It's ironic, therefore, that a majority of voters in Stoke-on-Trent voted for Brexit, and that includes heritage champion Councillor Dan Jelliman.
I voted to leave.
No regrets?
No, none at all. I still believe it's the right thing to do. The ceramics industry was not built on just exports to Europe. It was built on exports to the entire globe, and that's where we need to be aiming at.
He says after Brexit, Britain should be able to strike its own free trade deals with countries like, for example, the United States, where British tableware currently faces a 28% tariff. Jellyman wants to see this industry regain more of its former exporting glory.
I can't see, Brexit harming that. I can only see Brexit enhancing that, really, as we go forward.
But Laura Cohen of the British Ceramics Confederation says 0% import tariffs would be counterproductive.
It weakens our hand making trade deals with other countries, because if we give away access for free, why would anyone need to do a trade deal with us?
Since Parliament is expected to block a no-deal Brexit in tomorrow's vote, the import tariff cut seems unlikely. But British manufacturers, and not just ceramics companies, are still clamouring for the government to rule them out. In Stoke-on-Trent, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We've been talking about Brexit for what? Close to 3 years now, right? So it is put up or shut up time. We are going to go and see what's what. Explain why what's happening over there is going to matter over here and globally as well. We're leaving it in about 10 days. But before we go, shoot us whatever questions you have, would you? What maybe you don't quite get about Brexit? There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. True story, I work here, but I'm a listener as well. And as I was driving into work today, I had David Brancaccio on the radio on the Marketplace Morning Report, and he was talking to David Kelly at JP Morgan Asset Management about this morning's really pretty tame report on the Consumer Price Index, inflation, in other words. And at one point, David Kelly said this.
The reason why I think we've got low inflation is that a lot of the income is going to the upper 10% of households in America, and frankly, they're not spending the money.
That stuck with me, so when I got to work and we had our morning editorial meeting, we asked Marketplace's Kimberly Adams to dig in a little bit.
One of the reasons a growing economy tends to come with more inflation is because wages go up. And sure enough, average hourly earnings are up 3.4% from last year. But here's the thing about averages, according to Heather Boucher at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Because of inequality, the aggregate measure is no longer as illustrative of what's actually happening to the whole economy because we're pulling apart so much.
Most of the gains from the decade of economic recovery since the recession have gone to those in higher income brackets. And the wealthy, says David Wixer, an economist at Stony Brook University,
as a portion of their income, they buy less stuff. So even though they're consuming a lot, the fraction of income that ends up getting spent is decreasing as you move up the income scale.
And what they do spend on isn't necessarily the visible stuff that moves the CPI. They put more money into retirement or saving and intangibles.
Vacations and holidays and day spas, but it's also things like their health care and their kids' futures.
Elizabeth Curd Halkett researches the consumer economy at the University of Southern California.
Interestingly, if you look at consumer price index for those particular goods, those have actually really jumped.
Her classic example of this, the spike in college tuition. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We didn't plan it this way, I promise, but that's a pretty good segue because the higher education story of this Tuesday is firmly in the, wait, what category? Nearly 50 people, some famous, some just rich, were charged today in a $25 million cheating and bribery scheme, parents paying off college coaches and test administrators to get their kids into elite schools. It's a rare peek behind the curtain at the dark side of college admissions. Marketplace's Amy Scott has it.
The big story here is not that rich people paid somebody to get their kids into fancy schools. That's been going on forever.
The main difference seems to be who the bribes are being paid to.
Kevin Carey is vice president of education policy at the New America Foundation.
Usually the way you do that is by giving money directly to the university and buying your name on the side of a building or something like that.
But something like that can cost tens of millions. Prosecutors say Felicity Huffman of Desperate Housewives fame arranged to have the scores changed on her daughter's college entrance exam for $15,000. In another example, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling said the head women's soccer coach at Yale,
in exchange for $400,000, accepted an applicant as a recruit for the Yale women's team, despite knowing that the applicant did not even play competitive soccer.
The man who allegedly facilitated all this was admissions consultant William Singer. Kim Clark with the Education Writers Association says Singer took advantage of the notoriously opaque admissions process at elite schools.
I think if things were a little more open, then it would be less easy to sell parents on this idea that there are secret side doors.
But clearly there are, and those who can pay may spend even more to find the key. Cappy Hill is an economist and former president of Vassar College.
Higher income families are investing something like almost $10,000 more per year in their kids to get them ready for the competition when they're applying for college.
A competition, she says, already leaves lower income families at a disadvantage. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
coming up.
They are running programs that date back to the 1980s.
Governments and their technology, their old, old technology. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 96 points today, 0.3%, closed at 25,554. The NASDAQ gained 32 points, that's about 0.4%, 75.91. The S&P 500 up 8 points, almost 0.3%, 27.91 there. Boeing, we told you about. European rival Airbus gained 1.4% today. Wells Fargo President and CEO Tom Sloan told Congress today that the bank has cleaned up its act following multiple scandals affecting millions of customers. Wells Fargo shares down 0.2%. Sporting goods retailer Dick's announced it's going to stop selling all firearms at 125 of its stores nationwide. Stock down 11% today after reporting a decline in same-store sales. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 2.59%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Kaiser Permanente is taking another step into broader social policy. The healthcare giant announced yesterday it's going to make $3 million in grants to be spent in 15 communities across the country to fight chronic homelessness. As Raquel Maria Dillon reports now from KQED, the company has already been investing in housing policy in its hometown of Oakland, California.
This is my boudoir. This is my main room right here. The big old bed. I like to...
Amira Lipscomb is showing off her studio apartment. She moved in last August, and she loves it here.
You know, I actually have a stove, a refrigerator, a top, you know, range, sink.
Her rent is about $1,500 a month, and that's a pretty good deal in Oakland, where the average rent for a one-bedroom is $2,300 a month. So when the building was sold last November, she and her neighbors worried they'd be pushed out. But then nothing changed. Because the new owner is a nonprofit affordable housing developer.
I am so happy that they bought this building. I don't know what I would have done. I was feeling that somebody was going to get it and they were going to raise the rent.
The East Bay Asian Local Development Corporation is the new owner. Its current strategy is, instead of building affordable units, buy them, but hold rent steady. The hope is this will keep people from getting displaced.
You just cannot build your way out of this crisis.
Cherise Fong is the nonprofit's chief operating officer. She says the challenge is finding the capital to buy in Oakland's overheated housing market.
When we try and do these sales, you're running against private investors with all cash, and they often will beat you out.
So how did Fong's organization come up with the cash to buy Lipscomb's building? It got a low-interest loan from Kaiser Permanente, the healthcare company with headquarters in downtown Oakland. Here's Kaiser's CEO, Dr. Bernard Tyson, announcing the deal at a City Hall press conference.
$5.2 million to acquire a 41-unit affordable housing complex.
That was about half the money needed to buy Amira Lipscomb's building. The HMO also promised to partner with local social service agencies to provide health care and housing for 500 homeless people in Oakland, though it didn't provide details on how exactly it's providing that care. So what does Kaiser get out of this? Sure, it's good PR, but Robert Fryant of the Corporation for Supportive Housing says healthcare companies are recognizing that for people to be healthy, they need homes.
Not only does the health of the patient improve, the outcomes are better, but we all benefit because the cost of healthcare goes down.
Kaiser is investing $200 million in low-interest loans for affordable housing nationwide. This may be part of a national trend of hospitals investing in housing to improve community health. In Phoenix, UnitedHealthcare loaned money to a community development corporation called Chicanos por la Causa to purchase apartment complexes for Medicaid recipients. And in Chicago, the University of Illinois Hospital helps find permanent housing for homeless people who show up in their emergency room a lot. Oakland Mayor Libby Schaff used the announcement to call on other companies to pitch in.
If you have money sitting in your treasury that is not being fully utilized, this is a great way to use it. It will come back to you.
Yeah, thank you.
For Amira Lipscomb, there's a clear connection between health and home. She's a cancer survivor, and when she got sick, she lost her job as a cook and found herself on the street. She's still not working, and her rent is subsidized.
I love my honeycomb hideout. I come into my apartment and I breathe a sigh of relief because I lived one more day and I have roof over my head one more day.
Oakland estimates that by 2024, to meet the growing demand for housing, it will need to build 17,000 additional housing units and protect 17,000 existing units from rent hikes and evictions. In Oakland, I'm Raquel Maria Dillon for Marketplace.
We talk a lot on this program, and we all talk a lot in real life, probably, about how fast technology is moving. Artificial intelligence, everything in the cloud, just a whole lot of change real, real fast. Businesses, by and large, are keeping up because they kind of have to or die. Other parts of this economy, though, not so much. Specifically, governments. Vintage technology is the polite way to put what they are using. Romy Varghese covers technology for Bloomberg in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Do me a favor, would you, and tell me about the San Francisco assessor's office and how they do their IT.
Well, you'd be very surprised about how the assessor's office in San Francisco does their business.
I was surprised and horrified, by the way. Let me just tell you.
Well, right. We were talking San Francisco, the tech hub, where there are visionary companies and disruptive companies like Uber and Lyft. But in the tax assessor's office, they are running programs that date back to the 1980s. It's run on a programming language that's not even being taught anymore.
Yeah, there are so many things wrong with this story. Not the story itself, but the idea behind the story. I guess the first question has to be why? Why is San Francisco, and you look at other cities as well, they're running technology, some of them, that comes from the 1960s.
The problem with cities and their technology is that technology is just moving so quickly that these governments are getting further and further behind. And another problem is that this technology is now moving to things like the cloud.
Yeah.
and storage and software licenses, right? So now you can't borrow money. You can't sell bonds in the municipal bond market because you need to finance an asset.
Like an actual physical asset, like a computer server.
Exactly.
Right.
Like those big hulking servers.
Right.
You can't borrow money for licenses. So that makes it even more difficult for governments to budget this.
Not to get all technical, but software as a service, SaaS, is not easily municipally financeable, right?
Exactly. So these governments are faced with the prospect of paying for this out of their operating funds. So you're making a decision between a park, perhaps, or paying for something that your voters don't even see.
It would seem that there's room for a public-private partnership here. And I'm intrigued and mildly horrified by the kicker in your piece, that there is a private app that somebody has built to enable more rapid dog poop pickup or to report dog poop problems in San Francisco. I will leave the name of it unsaid, but it rhymes with Snap. in San Francisco, at least, could they not reach out and try something new? There's an app for that, right?
Yes, there's an app for that, but there's not an app for government functions that are so basic like taxation, because it's not very interesting to tech
job,
companies.
Yeah. What happens if cities don't fix this? I mean, how does this end?
It usually ends with a crisis. Yeah. You're going to get a situation where, say, your technology is working, it's just muddling along, but your longtime employee who knew all the workarounds decides to retire,
right,
which is going to happen. And then that's when it's going to hit a real crisis point, when voters are going to be steamed that they can't do these basic services. And that's bad news for the politicians who might be getting voted out.
Right. Which then becomes for them a crisis, right?
Exactly.
Romy Verghese, she's a Bloomberg reporter in San Francisco, writing about the antiquated, I think is a fair word to say, technology that a lot of city governments are running around this country. Romy, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, which is somehow not at all surprising. Just because nobody outside Robert Mueller's very closely held circle knows when his report is coming out, that does not mean you can't make money off it. Two publishers have set a pub date for their book versions of that report, March the 26th, for whatever that's worth. All right, we got to go. Dow off 96 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ was up 32 points. That's about 0.4%. S&P 500 up 8 points, almost 0.3% there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platts, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.